button. And of course, it's loaded in the hopper with those who are formally matriculated in the course. Okay, so great. We don't want to use that yet, though. I want to sharpen your panelists. And before I do, let me just ask each of you to figure out if you were going to be arguing an appeal of the master decision in the district court, would you be doing it on behalf of the appellant or the appellee? And I'm just wondering, how many people conceived of their appeal in favor of master? That's the case. How many conceived of their appeal in favor of the RIAA? Some more RIAA, but it sounds pretty laconic on both sides. Let me do this official show of hands. How many master lawyers? Okay, how many RIAA lawyers? And who didn't do an appeal at all? You, sir. What is your name?
Jeff Boyd.
Jeff Boyd. What's your reason for not doing an appeal over the other?
You
went to a fish concert last week. That will be duly noted by the people on the show with a good concert, and worth the expense, if you know what I mean. Okay. If it were something other than fish, I might feel a little more sympathetic. Okay, so Jason Martin, where's Jason? Yeah. Jason. There you are, Jason. Are you feeling inclined towards the RIAA or NASTER?
Are you asking what law is or what law ought to be?
Well, here we go. The answer to the question was a question. But the ought is distinction, which I specifically told you to ask about, so I guess I can't be too upset. I'm asking, what is the law? Let's be doctrinal. This is the one session which we would be at our most lawyerly. We're talking about doctrine and law, statutes and cases. So, who ought to win under the law as you know it today?
All right. And is that the entity for whom you're prepared to take the case?
Sure. All right, so just give me, in a really compact form, the best argument that says RIAA should win.
The best argument for RIAA is that NAFTA knows that the contributing copyright infringement has been asked to take down the copyright infringement material. NAFTA claims that it cannot do so without taking down the whole site, and therefore it is to take down the site. Therefore, it is infringing on the copyright of all the artists for whom the recording industry holds copyright and is liable for contributory copyright infringement.
Okay, so what we have, I'm looking at what our scribe is doing. Let's make sure this is true to what you're saying. NAFTA knows it's contributing to copyright infringement. It has knowledge that it is contributing. Maybe we mean by that it has knowledge that copyright infringement is taking place with the aid of a good operator.
Yeah.
Okay. Has been asked to remove the infringing material, thinks that it can't do so without destroying the site, so it refuses. This sounds like arguments of ad disaster, in which you say, who cares if it puts you out of business? We're very sorry. That's your argument. Now, does anybody want to take issue on the other side with this argument? Mel, did you prepare? I know you're not a lawyer with that, but.
I actually agree with that.
No. I wouldn't want anybody to make that I want to do. But. Okay, I'll put that there. MLJ concurred. Can you flesh it out? Is this sufficient? A description to do it. We're textuous, we're putting together a text here. Is there anything you want to add to this statement of things, this little paragraph?
I might want to get into a little bit about what the law ought to be,
No. I don't want to talk about the law at the end.
You don't want to get there.
No.
Okay. Let me just text it.
Here's another one. All right, I'll try this one. In the Borenberg room. Hello?
Just turn it on.
Turn it on, yeah. Okay. It's not even belly all the time. Yeah. Okay. Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. We're doing a separate camp. How about that? Hello, Cleveland? Hello? All right. So at some point, I'll stop bellowing when I hear feedback. Okay, so maybe go ahead.
The idea of restricted rights, and one of the things that I thought about was the difference between the individual versus the master and the facilitator, actually.
So if you can't go after the fleas, you might as well go after the pile of them. So I don't know what the right analogy would be, the right metaphor. But because you can't go after the little guy, it's particularly important to have somebody to pin the problem on, and Napster is in a position to receive that.
Napster,
And this sounds a little bit then like the swap meet. The swap meet is which contributory infringement was found by the person that kind of organized the swap meet, even though the organizers didn't actually traffic in any of the material, and perhaps some of the material was in fact not infringing. So from what we know about the standard for contributory infringement, does this seem like we've ended the story? Does nobody really stand up? Yeah, go ahead. Okay, so we have it. We introduced the idea that to have contributory infringement, you've got to have some underlying direct infringement. The swap meet, it was a direct infringement caused by the trafficking of these unauthorized bootleg tapes. You have to have an underlying direct infringement. You just can't find that person, or you choose not to go after that person, and instead you go after a contributory infringer. You still have to have underlying infringement, and as you say, there is no underlying infringement.
Well, you know, you make it say you don't know.
You sound confident in your position. Let us try the cold call engine. I just want to give this thing a shot. Try the cold call engine, maybe it's not there. All right, so give me an A. Okay, so Ben really hasn't been paid enough. Give us another day. Adrian Hunter. Are you here, Adrian? Where is Adrian? Right here. All right, so help us out here. Is there direct infringement going on by the users of Napster? And if there's something you feel you need to know in order to answer that question, feel free to ask it. So you give me an answer of what it would take for you to be able to give an answer. You have to know if the material they were receiving is copyrighted. It's true that there can't be infringement of copyrighted material unless you start with copyrighted material. So how do we go about figuring that out for Napster? Well, it turns out there's a formalistic way you could say this. You could say, yeah, you guys, the RIAA, you need to give to us a list of all the copyrights you hold for all the songs, and then show us where those specific songs are on the server. Now that actually was tried in this report, and the RIAA said, we have so many, that would be really hard. Rest assured though, we know there's a bunch out there, don't we? And that appears to be a largely sufficient answer to this report, for better or worse, to say that there's some copyrighted stuff on it. Now it would be enough at least to use Napster. Have the judge use Napster. Ask for files with titles that resemble the titles of copyrighted songs, grab those files, listen to them, and if in fact they are the copyrighted songs, are we agreed that there is direct infringement when somebody downloads that particular song?
Yes.
You say yes. Are we agreed that that is direct infringement? Sarah says no.
Oh, it depends on whether or not they meet the requirements of driving. If you need this for requirements, that's sort of why I think one of the possibilities that you may have a copyright of it is
All right, so let's see how the scribing is doing. Maybe there's a way to reorganize this so that it looks sort of like a logical flow of an argument. Because one might be direct infringement. Start with that. If you have direct infringement, then you have a third party who helps the direct infringement. Now, there might be some other elements, but we're trying to get a contributory infringement. And what we're now speaking to is under 4, we're just trying to talk at under Roman numeral 4 before we get to A on the direct infringement point. We're trying to figure out, was there in fact direct infringement? And we've already asked two questions. Question one is, are they copyrighted files on master? And we have a feeling that some of them are, some of them aren't. And secondly, if they are copyrighted files, is the use to which the files are put by the people who use master perhaps covered by some fair use defense, and therefore there is no successful claim for direct infringement because somebody grabbing the copyrighted file is making some fair use of it. So these are all attacks that are based on whether there's an underlying direct infringement by master users. We can argue also about, even if there is, if there's contributory infringement, we're trying to organize our thoughts a little bit around this. Okay, so how do we figure out whether or not the use to which the files are put is a fair use? How do we know that? What would we look to figure out the answer to that question? Yeah?
I used to check some other different copyright acts that before any.
Right, so we go to that four-factor test that was up on the screen yesterday, and what does this tell us?
It tells us that you can characterize certain issues that are not profitable for educational purposes, then that would be fair use, and therefore it's a great thing to get to the
question. Of course, it's not as simple as it is then, right? These are just factors to be considered when weighing under a totality of the circumstances whether it's fair use. But to be sure, bless you, the more you can make something non-commercial, personal, private, not harmful to the commercial interests of the person who holds the copyright, and perhaps also as a factor of, if you're doing it for good reasons, educational, free speechy kinds of reasons, you add those together, the more you have them, the more you go towards fair use, the more you don't, the more you don't. And thus, what we have to end up examining for this part of the argument, perhaps the economic impact that the copying has on the copyright holder. And yet, on the court below, there were arguments about that. There was a battle of the experts, where in fact many of the experts on the defense side were thrown out for various reasons. So you had a battle of the experts, trying to figure out if master is in fact hurting or helping the market for the copyrighted works that may in fact be trafficked there. The court below seemed to give great credence to the idea of the disciplinary injunction phase that says, come on, we know it's hurting the work. If you can get it for free, why would you go ahead and buy it later? Yes, no problem. Not a shout, I can't hear it. So you might say then that, I don't know if people heard that, did people hear what you said? All right, I'll just have to shout it out again and hope it up. Look at the process. That it's the company's right to have a crappy business model. If in fact we know that NASA really boosts the sales for those songs and artists who are well featured there, it's okay if the company chooses not to want to have the music distributed that way. And why should the fact that it chooses to do it that way militate against the finding of copyright infringement simply because, you know, maybe it's not hurting them that much? The only reason you can think of is the fair use section of copyright seems to suggest that the impact on the economic market for the original work has some bearing on whether or not you even call the use of the work fair use. This also gets the idea of moral rights. And different copyright regimes internationally, you have stronger or weaker moral rights, moral rights being the right of an author simply to control distribution of the work, irrespective of the financial gains that he had through one particular kind of control or another. In the United States copyright law, Section 106A of the Copyright Act has some things about limited moral rights in visual work, but more or less, United States copyright law tends not to give much of the tip of the hat towards moral rights. Instead, it says, what we care about is an engine for making money for people. Part of the engine is allowing them to monopolize the work so they can extract monopoly rents for it out in the market. Yes, Darren. There's no particular hard and fast rule that I can point you to that says if you haven't lost money, you can't demonstrate that you lose. It's a different thing. We'll talk a little about libel later on. After all, libel is just another form of reputation rights. It's just a form of controlling data about yourself, maybe true or false. And there, you may have to show actual material injury to you if somebody says something false. In this instance, often, so long as the copying was willful, you get so-called statutory damages. You can recover some basic amount just as the copyright was infringed, so long, again, as it isn't fair use. And part of fair use is what it do to the economic market for the thing that was infringed. As you can see, this is incredibly, if not outright complicated, circular economy. It's unclear to know whether you're infringing the copyright thanks to the fair use formula that includes economic value. But if, in fact, you are infringing the copyright, economic value need not be impaired in order to be awarded something. Yeah.
And this is going to be a pretty good topic. Back to the idea of monopoly rights.
Yes.
By which the music is distributed either in a secure format,
some ways makes it hard to copy. Or even if you distribute it, you can make MP3 files, say, varying levels of quality. So you can distribute a kind of scratchy Tom Petty, I guess that's redundant stuff, an ultra scratchy Tom Petty track. And then if you really want to hear it in full fidelity, you've got to go buy the CD. It's kind of a brain damage, but you know, it's the pictures you might see online stamped sample across it. And you know, you can't really use the thing as an example, but it gives you a sense of what you'd get if you were to buy it. So maybe there are alternative ways, either in the present, like crappy quality, or in the future, like a secure scheme that could help out. Now here's another aspect that should come into play. How many people in reading the opinion took note of the discussion of the Audio Home Recording Act? Any questions? Note of that. Did anybody go to the trouble of actually looking up the Audio Home Recording Act? So I encourage you, reading an opinion, read it as if you really need to understand it. So if there's a paragraph about section 1008 of the copyright law, something about the Audio Home Recording Act, it's just a click away. You jump onto Westlaw, 17 U.S.C. 1008, and boom, you have the Audio Home Recording Act right in front of you. So for instance, let's see what we would find if we went to the Audio Home Recording Act. Because this is a separate argument that Master made and the court below didn't care much for. Is there any easy way then that you can find section 1001, 17 U.S.C.? I guess we have bad men, it has so far to go. It's quite slow. Alright, so that is looking for the specifics. Yeah, the specifics. Let me try to give you a recapitulation and let anybody feel that he or she can confidently discuss the audio home recording. Oh my God, that's what you can. Yeah, Henry.
Well, a lot of details, but one of the concepts of the audio home recording is that the consumers can copy and distribute digital music that's run off in the commercial use. That's also because of the diamond.
Yeah. So the Audio Home Recording Act, that's a pretty good summary there, came out of another jihad of sorts. This was a war between Sony and other producers of gadgets and holders of copyrighted material. Because what was about to come on to the market was the digital audio tape recorder. The DAT would let you put a CD into your CD player and then buy a DAT tape. And actually, oh, there we are. You could put the DAT into your DAT recorder and tape the CD. And when you did, you would have a digitally true copy of that CD. Forget about MP3 compression. This was an exact duplicate. And then you could play the DAT on a portable DAT player. It didn't skip around when you jog as much as the CD would. And what's worse, you could then take the DAT, give it to your friend. The friends could copy from one DAT to another, and the second generation copy would be every bit as good as the first. This was seen as a disaster by the copyright holders, who after all were charging monopoly rent for original digital copies in CD form of their music. And Sony, which at the time did not have the same kind of relationship with copyright holders as it does, corporately speaking now, said, too bad, our customers are our customers, we're going to make this thing. And they couldn't come to agreement, so it came to Congress. And Congress got lobbied hard on all sides. And this is a wonderful act to read, to actually look at the sausage that got made as a result of this battle. So 1001 is so interesting, but check out 1002. 1001 is much a definition. I guess 1002? There's section 1002. No person shall import, manufacture, distribute any digital audio recording device or audio interface device that does not conform to the serial copy management system or something that's a lot like it. And not only that, you're not allowed to build anything with a circumvented system. Now you may ask, what is the serial copy management system? Congress doesn't say. This is the only reference in the Act to the capitalized serial copy management system. But I'll tell you what it is because we all know what it is. Serial copy management system is something that lets you tag digital data, music in particular, as to whether in fact it's original or a copy. And what the system is designed to do is to make it so that a device that incorporates the system will not copy a copy. So you can buy a DAT player, copy a CD to a DAT, but if you give the DAT to a friend, it will not be copied to a second DAT because the FCMS says so. And Congress says, if you're in the business of building something that looks like a DAT, you've got to have this system inside. So there, Sony. An interesting way of just mandating a particular technology. We know who the gadget makers are. We just make the rule, and then they have to obey it. What did that do to the market for digital audio tape recorders? I don't know, how many of you own a digital audio tape recorder? Okay, so it didn't help the market for digital audio tape recorders, because after all, the only reason you really want one would be to copy. Now, if you look actually at 1004, you start really digging into the things. If you were to have done this, you would have gotten curious, right? What are the rest of the elements of the Audio Home Recording Act? Here's subchapter C, royalty payments. What is this about royalty payments? It turns out that they weren't satisfied with just having the copy control. Instead, if you make something like a DAT and you sell it, you have to take a percentage of the value of your sale and send it to the U.S. government. 2% of the transfer price. You send this to the U.S. government, and I'll render it, I have to put it in a special account, and this money starts piling up. Keep going. And there's the maximum it can be, blah, blah, blah. And, okay, go to the next session. So what have we done? We've collected a pile of money now for the people to make DATs. What do we do with that pile of money? There's the deposit of the royalty payments. Okay, we put it in the Treasury of the United States. Blah, blah, blah. Keep going. So the IRS draft to account for it. Now there are certain interested copyright parties. Interested copyright parties. Those are people whose musical work or sound recording has been buying an additional music recording or an analog recording lawfully made under the title that's been distributed. In other words, anybody that ever made music is an interested copyright party. And what you can do is have a claim for some of this royalty money. And here's the fund. Here's the allocations. Ready for this? The U.S. law we're reading. 66 2/3% of the royalty payments shall be allocated to the sound recordings fund. 2 5/8% of the royalty payments allocated to that fund shall be placed in an escrow account managed by an independent administrator jointly appointed by the interested in copyrighted party and the American Federation of Musicians or any successor entity to distribute to non-featured musicians to perform on sound recordings distributed in the United States. 1 3/8% of the payments to be placed in an escrow account. In other words, it takes some of the trouble. And in very exact proportion, they each get a little bit of slump. I don't mean to tell you the pejorative way. I'm just saying that what you had was saying, we're going to get rid of most of the illicit copy and we think we can go on with these DATs. And for the rest, because we're allowing DATs to exist after all, they just have to have the copy management system in them. For the rest, we're going to collect a tax, and then that tax will be distributed to people whose music we presume has been copied, and the people have been deprived of their money because it was copied without payment to the original music recorder. An amazing legislative social engineering solution to a problem that is completely transparent to the consumer. You just find that your Sony deck for some reason won't copy, sometimes if you want to, or you find that the deck is a little bit more expensive and you need not particularly know why. Now, why is any of this relevant to the master case? It's relevant because there was one more thing featured in the Audio Home Recording Act in section 1008. Yeah, summer loyalty payment thing. You want subchapter D. No action may be brought under this title alleging infringement of copyright based on the manufacture, importation, or yada yada of digital audio recording device, or based on the non-commercial use by a consumer, such a device or media, for making digital musical recordings or analog musical recordings. What does this statement mean? This is an interesting statement, because it says something that runs contrary to the basic rules we even through yesterday. It's saying, actually, that you can't bring an action for copyright infringement. Again, if you look at the last phrase, the non-commercial use by a consumer of such a device medium for making digital music recordings or analog musical recordings. So what that says is, if I buy one of these DATs and I use it to make copies of a CD, so long as my activity is non-commercial, I am not infringing copyright. I don't even have to go to the fair use provision. I don't have to rely on fair use. I am simply, well, maybe I should be more exact, that I am not infringing copyright, or that I am infringing copyright, perhaps, but no action may be brought. Maybe it's a right without remedy. It could be that. Lawyers have been known to make a lot out of such small distinctions. Napster seized on this to say, the people who use Napster are simply doing non-commercial use by a consumer making digital musical recordings. So any time a consumer of Napster downloads something, it is not copyright infringement. So,
but then wouldn't the earlier article then mandate that Napster, if they're considering digital recording, that it conforms to serial copyright?
Yeah, you would think so. Because Napster, of course, doesn't conform to the serial copy management system. It's not clear that it even could, even a device, if the act understands it. And that's what the other side shot back and what the judge bought. That moved a long way. But that's the argument that you're going to have. And if you'll find it very interesting, I recommend, but don't require, that you actually read the briefs on appeal. They are respectively on the RIAA site and on the Napster site. The appellate brief now the Ninth Circuit arguing over Judge Patel's opinion. Now we've read her opinion and we're starting to argue a little bit about it, although I'm lecturing right now. It'll be very informative. I think I actually find it fun to read these arguments.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to me there is a precedent for in support of the injunction.
Yeah.
Where you think it's pretty serious that a personal computer doesn't even count as a digital audio recording device, and that part of it could be construed as a digital audio recording device because other files and other things can sort of imagine.
Correct. It would probably be, and this is a good use perhaps of ad disaster, a terrible thing if hard drives were suddenly thought to be subject to the audio home recording. Clearly, the people who wrote it weren't trying to get hard drives into it. Of course, in 1992, hard drives weren't what they are today, but still, you don't get the sense that that's what they had in mind. And if they did have it in mind, boy, would a lot have to change if hard drives and computers would incorporate this FTMS. And so then you say it's not subject to the FTMS. Neither is this exception to liability applicable. But you may or may not be impressed by that. John?
Why do you have to think that the AHRA provisions could have been confirmed in the sense that the claim wasn't brought under the AHRA and the original?
Because they just look at 1008 standing alone. Let's just pull 1008 up there. And they get a lot, and perhaps we have a little laser point, but I guess they use the phrase of things like such as. Of such a device or medium. They say such a device or medium means a device or medium like it. It doesn't actually have to be one, it can just be like it. So it isn't one under the AHRA, but it's like one, and as a result, this is what the AHRA is for. Because this is section 1008 of Title 17, and it does say under this title. It doesn't say under this act, it says no action may be brought under this title. So they say that's Title 17, that's all the copyright. I agree, though it may be a little bit clever, my hat. All right, so let's see where we are in fleshing out the argument back on the scribe's screen. Can we just jump up? There's the argument. We wanted to show direct infringement. Was there direct infringement? The archive was copy written.
I don't know how you spell copyright. I think it's copyrighted with an R-I-G-H.
Well, we can discuss it later. Was the use of which files was put a fair use? I don't know whether I'm going to get a fair use thing. And now what we've done is elaborated a number three to this, which was the 1008 right there. I don't know. How many people, how much did you buy the 1008 argument on behalf of Napster? All right, that's not a lot of people. Not that we're doing judicial reasoning by being late, but it's good to get a sense of what the feeling is in the room. Okay, so if you were convinced by the Title 17, Section 1008 argument, so are they copyrighted? Is there direct convincing going on? Is there any other argument to say that at least many of the uses we have reason to think after it's being put, perhaps by our own personal experience, is not direct infringement of the holder of the original copyright. Let's pull out the full scholar here. You've got to remember my question. I'm told by the screen that I'm going to show it's Philip Parenthal. Where's Philip? All right, Philip. How much money do you need to pay? Please don't suffer in silence, quite literally. Tell me if I need to actually shout myself hoarse today.
That's only when you like turn away.
Only when I turn away. Because no, I hate him. I gotta say, AB is gonna pay.
If you're not just ridiculous. No, I just turned it up before.
I know, but it's not worth it. The battery is dead.
Is the footnote that features Mr. Rogers. I think Mr. Rogers actually turned the tide in the Sony case. You see, the Sony case was the Audio Home Recording Act kind of argument held before there was the Audio Home Recording Act argument. It's the same form of the argument. Sony makes gadgets. Sony is labeled a bad boy by the publishers because the gadgets assist in the infringement of copyright, or so it's alleged. And we try to go after the maker of the gadget rather than the individual infringers because those are schemes that are hard to go after. So we try to make a contributory infringement case against Sony for daring to manufacture the VCR, or as we call them, the VCR. This is a case that has some cool parallels to the Napster case and even to the kinds of arguments that were had over the DAP. So let's just review a little bit of the Sony case. What happened was you have three broadcasts going over the airwaves. People now can record it onto their VCRs. And despite the fact that the broadcast is free, you're still making a copy of it. And to make a copy is a right held exclusively by the copyright holder, so aren't you infringing? So would you all say, somebody, direct infringement to take something off of television is what you know. Rachel, Valenti, tell me, the direct infringement. Why is it direct infringement to record something off TV? Oh, actually, because of the Sony case, it's not. We figured it's in Sony 1. It must be not direct infringement. Well, that's good reasoning. Sony did, in fact, win in a 5-4 decision, you might want to know. A very close decision by which the VCR was rescued from some form of oblivion. And the argument that was made, if you went to the contributory infringement piece of it, was how do we measure those uses of the device that are clearly direct infringement against those that we hypothesize are not? This is the weird move you have to make as you go from direct infringement to contributory infringement. Somehow you have to choke up all of the uses of the device in question to figure out if it's purely used for copyright infringement. It would seem that the manufacturer might more readily be seen to be aiding and abetting the direct infringement and would acknowledge that that's what he or she was doing, than if only some small percentage of the uses is allowed or is deemed to be infringement. Now, the Sony court came up with a fairly broad reading of those uses. And in a footnote, they quoted Mr. Rogers. You see, because Mr. Rogers actually, his deposition was taken, and he said he was actually thrilled and delighted when people recorded his program on television. Very frankly, I'm opposed to people being programmed by others. My whole approach in broadcasting has always been, you are an important person just the way you are. Maybe I'm going on too long, but I just feel that anything that allows a person to be more active in the control of his or her life in a healthy way. Justice Stevens shed tears when he read this deposition. Oh, there it is. It actually is in the decision. And guess what? There's a whole bunch of people out there that broadcast and stuff and aren't happy to have a copy. If we ban the VCR, it can't be copied. There are kids who are going to be at school when the project is on. They'll come home from school and find that they can't watch it unless mom or dad can tape it. And we need the VCR to do it. It's a legitimate use. And how dare the copyright holders try to preclude all uses of the VCR simply because some uses aren't so good. That was the argument that in many ways prevailed. There are some perfectly non-infringing uses that there's a copyright holder saying, I don't care. And further, we find this time shifting, taping it now to watch it later, to itself be fair use. An individual act of time sharing is an act of fair use, so that is not infringing. And since those are substantial non-infringing uses of the VCR, Yes, the back question.
Sure. It just seems to be that the decision of Sony, though, is also very curious. At the time, VCRs weren't that flexible. You pretty much recorded a block of time with your entire choice, and the main revenue stream, the broadcasting, which is advertising, was more or less left as part of the recording in the process. You could fast forward through it, but it's still there. On VCR, if we have a case again today, that basically our program has to skip commercials and to completely take away that revenue stream. I would think the core might think $5 impact is very useful to Tipper.
Yeah. And just to come back to you, I noticed there's sort of a whole community here of people on the floor. Welcome. You know, the seats are fine, I think. This is just terrible. I feel bad that the fire marshal seems worse. So please, try to find a seat. There's just like at least three up front. I don't know. Let me see your pocket. Okay. So you say that was a whole different economic model when we look at fair use. And after all, the component that isn't the Mr. Rogers component of Sony, the component that is the I don't have permission, but it's okay because it's fair use and it's only time shifting. One of the factors of fair use is what the economic impact on the market for the original item. And you make a good point, Peter, that the economic impact may be quite negligible. Because the more people who see the program along with the ad, and those old Sony VCRs were really bad at doing a fast forward through the ad, it was just worth it to do it and wait rather than try to figure out where to play it, wasn't affecting the revenue model. And clearly, in the Napster case, it's a whole different ballgame. Most of this stuff is sold, and it's a direct substitute for the paid version of something. So that's exactly what we've seen the RIA come back with, even as Napster has invoked the Sony case to flesh out a theory of contributory infringement that says we're going to tote up direct infringement versus uses that are non-infringing, and if we can come up with enough non-infringing uses, we win. Yes, TJ.
Just a bit of a question along the lines of but why did, if they really invoke the Sony case, why did they fully invoke the Mr. Rogers argument to go with the, go with the fact that there are a lot of users out there that are assigned to the record labels who are supporting Napster? It did seem in the decision that came out, that really came out, and there was a lot of pro support. Like, again, the Mr. Rogers argument just went along the lines of, because it's good, that I approve of this, and like you're saying, there's all these producers of shows out there that are approving of it. There's a lot of producers of music out there, right? There's not record labels like Blink 182,
right,
and others that are, that are supportive of the action.
Well, this gets at the question under the heading of contributory infringement, is this contributory infringement, is how we measure infringing versus non-infringing uses. Because when you talk about Napster, you can come up with a statistic from the plaintiff that says something like 98% of the music traded on Napster, people are not happy about. The copyright holders don't want it traded. If so facto, the 2% is de minimis. Come on, this is a piracy tool. And we have quotations from the 18-year-old co-founder of Napster that are very useful in court, which he said, of course it's all pirated. That's the point. We're going to make a lot of money on it. And there's a great line. I urge you to read this. There's a great line in the brief by Napster on appeal, which says, surely the statements of an 18-year-old, not in a legal context, should be construed against an entire company, which is now under professional management. It's a great example. I don't know how much the court will buy that. So the 98% figure is one way of measuring it. And then if you're Napster, what are other statistics you can try to use? Somebody who's trying to help out Napster, give me somebody on this panel. Who on this panel is feeling sympathetic towards Napster? Owen Lewis, are you feeling sympathetic?
Yes. In terms of other uses, a lot of making sure that those people will download the cards first. That was one of the arguments that we made. We go back to the application. The arguments to be for the people who are practicing the same thing.
So people are mostly done. Let me just ask, let's just do a quick informal survey, totally unscientific. When you use Napster, do you primarily use it to download music from all brain cats? When you use Napster, do you primarily use it to hear things you haven't heard before? Alright, so that's,
the other argument for calling that is that I don't know about the music, perhaps you're saying that there is no law for brain cameras, and that a lot of people bypass over it.
Yeah, it's kind of, you steal it from the store, you listen to it, and then you return it and buy it if you want.
That's right.
Yeah, this was the, they're just trying it. They haven't heard it before, but if they like it, they're going to buy it. Then you get into the battle of the experts as to how many people will actually do this.
Another argument is you can't negotiate, you can't get money back, that it's out of between what it's like and what actually the document that we actually think about that. Is it either a position to copy the concert?
Yeah, Metallica seems to like bootlegs. If you actually tape a Metallica concert and put that up on Napster, they have no problem with it, they say. It's just copying their own stuff. And we get into the argument we can't tell the infringing from the non-infringing. But let's create another header here for that. I don't know how well this scribes working is capturing the argument as we're trying to elaborate. But another aspect of this argument sort of gets to remedy, which is by how much do we have to keep out non-infringing uses as well as infringing uses if in fact we are held to be contributorily infringing on copyright by the existence of Napster. That seems to be a question of some relevance because it helps on add to Napster. We're going to have to shut this whole thing down if you find that we are contributorily infringing. And it's also a little bit placed into the Digital Millennium Copyright Act argument, which we just reviewed at the end. I'm sorry, there are so many statutes to bear on this, but this has been a heavily legislated area. And at some point shortly, we have to look at the DMCA and see how that fits in to this four act. But is there any other thing, just hold me on for a moment to this point about 98% of the songs on Napster are copyrighted and they're being copied against the wishes of the copyright holder. Is there any other statistic that might help Napster out there that might have to do with other artists? It's a very specific fishing expedition. Daniel Haley, are you feeling like a fish?
He didn't
go to a fish concert.
You're asking for another statistic.
I need more examples. This is now a medium question. What if I were to tell you that the amount of music actually represented by the RIAA is but a small sliver of the music out there because so many people, we're not counting singing in the shower, but pretty much anything beyond that, lines its way onto the tape, counts as music. And there are plenty of new artists that have a time to label that like to have their music traded through Napster. And in fact, isn't it a little bit trying to keep a corner on the market by spamming out the swap fee, including for artists who are happy to have a swap, and there are tons of artists this way. And there's a great statistic in the Napster brief that says there were approximately 2,000 records released last year by professional record companies. That's it, 2,000 last year. Every other piece of music, and there are thousands of tracks of music out there that was made by people doing it by themselves who aren't looking to sell it and sell a record.
I hope your company did all that. I feel like the court was pretty contentious
in
that. The court was pretty contentious, I think. Rightly so, only because they didn't, it was kind of tied in the sky, an ideal world of what Napster would be used for, but then you look at how Napster set the box up, and they didn't even start curling out to artists until the lawsuit was pending, and then they had revivalists, new artists, kind of weird stuff that indicated they were really going to just
throw their... Yeah, they had this new artists program, right? And the new artists program was a way of highlighting new artists to work with them, but it seemed like an afterthought in response to litigation as a big leap to say, oh yeah, by the way, we worry about new artists. Now this also, aside from how much music out there could be represented by Napster, yes, it's a question of when we look to the Sony test for substantial non-infringing uses. Should we think of them as actual uses, things to which apparently the device is being put right now, or somehow potential uses? Could we just hypothesize the scheme reasonable, non-infringing, and as a result, are okay? Now, in the Sony case, the VCR hadn't yet really hit the market, so they were definitely having to think about it as a potential. What do we project the market will do with it? Of course, the Napster case is already out there. They're trying to shut it down. And that is definitely a point of cleavage between the RIAA and Napster and now the judge and Napster. The judge says, let's gather empirical data about what's really happening here. How is it being used and not used? And that's how we decide there are substantial non-essential uses. And therefore, we decide if it's contributory infringement to actually exist versus trying to hypothesize potential uses. You mean the language of Sony directly is telling you to look to potential uses. And indeed, with Sony, in that case, they're realizing that we won't know about the uses until until the VCR gets out there. It's an object that we either get a distribution channel to Circuit City, or it won't. We're going to flush it, or we won't. With Napster, you can imagine, write it down, make it available now, and you pull it back for a while, and you put it back in the stream, etc., etc. Okay, so is our argument so far clear? Ben seems skeptical that it's clear. There's too much text to make it a kind of clean outline. But at least from the panel, what I think hopefully the panel can generate coming out of this class, is the actual outline of the argument, elaborated back and forth, so that by the end of, if not today, today, by the end of this week, we'll really have a sense for the ways in which the parties are engaged on this. And again, this is where they have a fusillade on both sides of statutory arguments to make and cases to invoke. Okay, questions at this stage on what we've been talking about? Any questions at all? Yes, Alan. You're saying each individual person who downloads is having such a little effect on the market?
Right, and then,
Alex can ask the question, if we look at it one person at a time, it's not really taking money out of anybody's pocket. Of course it is, though. Except for the fact that it is. It's not taking any money out of it. Well, remember, the person who swap meet was held contributorily infringing because collective rent, some people that have the booths and such. And NASA says, we don't collect anything from anybody. We just give them the space in our directory. That's all we are, a directory of file names. That's all it is. It's not even descriptions of files. They're literally file names and underscores. So many of you have used it. I didn't, I chose to ask that not to demo NASA today. Just turn the person to your right or to your left if you haven't used NASA in a period. At some point, we'll be wired so you can use it while you're actually in the room. very attractive music. So where was all that going? The swap meet owner is making money, is Napster making money? But of course, Napster is a business, right? They just got a bunch of money from Hummer Winkleland. It's, you know, true. That's a Napster known for money. That's a stupid idea. But there are a number of cases. Judge sites say non-commercial doesn't mean you don't make money. It just means you're not in the business of doing what you do. Plenty of money-losing enterprises are, in fact, commercial. They're just poorly run or subject to structural strain, about to go bankrupt, or for some other reason, not making money. But they are commercial under the law, nonetheless. I think that's what Judge Hell was saying.
Yeah,
Chuck.
What are the requirements for vicarious or contributory copyright infringement that the person facilitating the infringement knows that it's going on?
Right.
You know, from my understanding of the ATF to set up its system so that it wouldn't and couldn't know who was doing what at any particular time.
Yes.
So maybe it knew that it was possible to do this,
yes.
And for all practical purposes knew what was going on, but they didn't know that IP address number X did this on this date, although they could set it up so they did know that. And the question that I'm wondering is, for this, I guess, future enterprises like this, is there an affirmative duty of something like Napster to record this, or if they first set the system up so they don't know, are they still charged with constructive knowledge? It seems here they are.
How many people heard the question? All right, most, maybe about 75% of people heard the question. I'll do my best to recapitulate it. If you intentionally design the technology so you will be in a see no evil Oh, there's a question right there.
Well, I need an official report.
See no evil, hear no evil kind of setup. Can you then turn around and say, I don't know, and have that be your defense to a claim of contributory infringement? In some ways, it seems unfair, because after all, you could be in a position of knowing. On the other hand, do we want to start telling people if they have to design software so it starts tracking people all the time, or otherwise monitoring them? Now, that came up as a case, and so I've repeatedly arguing about that. The RIA tries to trump any question of that by saying, yes, but we have the 18-year-old, and he just said flat out, he knows. Right? So maybe he doesn't know specific instances, but he knows, and there it is, plain as day, end of story, he has knowledge. And I think the NASA lawyers have to do a lot of digging to get the 18-year-old out of a hole. But what they should have had is a slightly older person would say, we're making our business not to acquire the users of our facility, and in fact, due to our many discussions with the Federal Trade Commission, we have a very strict privacy policy by which we don't even gather data about the IIA. Of course, NASA can't quite say that because they do have data about what tracks you get, and they can market similar things to you later. So in a way, they're a little bit having knowledge of the kinds of things you might at least get as a bit by a filing, whatever a filing might be. They gave an example of a file that was Aquarius.mp3. They said that could be anything. It could be the age of Aquarius. It could be something else. And in fact, we have no idea what it is. This is really important. They have no idea what Aquarius.mp3 in a given location is. And therefore, just by our 18-year-old, we don't have knowledge as to what is going on. So to answer your question, I don't know. I don't know to what extent there could be an affirmative duty on software coders to have to build stuff in so that they'll be in a position to know if they don't already. The only real statutory guidance we have on this comes from the last piece of law, I think that we have to drop today, which is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA, codified 512 here, thank you, Ben, have a whole section 512, if you remember it from yesterday, that's supposed to give you some sense of immunity if you do certain things. This was the bargain between the ISP community, right? The ISPs and the OSPs that are starting to get powerful, and the copyright holders. And the compromise they struck says, let's see, if you are in the business, what section am I looking at? I don't know. Whether or not I do not know this stuff, cool. It's a safe harbor. 512B, thank you very much. Section 512B, thank you very much. 512B, my lord. This is national, keep going. Information is up, keep going. That's the wrong B. It's a little B. There it is. Oh, we had it. Information location tool. A service provider cannot be liable for monetary relief while the law for infringing the copyrights by reason of the provider referring or linking users to an online location containing infringing material or infringing activity by using information location tools if the provider does not have actual knowledge of the material or activity is infringing, in the absence of such actual knowledge, not aware of the facts or circumstances which infringing activity is apparent, or upon obtaining such knowledge, acts expeditiously to remove. Alright, so there's if A, B, and C, which is down below. You might want to highlight that better. Maybe make it a little bigger so that's how people can read it. Alright, so there's the one A, B, and C, yeah. And you do not receive a financial benefit directly attributable to the infringing activity. In a case in which the service provider has the right and ability to control such activity. This is very carefully crafted language. And if you actually look at the legislative background to it, you can tell that what they're trying to do is let all of Vista off the hook while keeping Napster on the hook. That's the general idea. They don't say Napster outright, they just say piracy search engine. Search engine specifically targeted to find pirated material. And of course, Napster is not necessarily that, the search engine is not find music files of whatever stripe they may be. So a lot of hay is made of this piece of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which after all has become part of copyright law, and is yet another immunity-style carve-out, presuming to meet the requirements of the safe harbor. Not enough. Somebody can tell me whether you think master policy, or even though you already heard me say that they were trying to say master off the hook. Let me get somebody else on the panel. Iris, Chad. Yeah, what do you think?
I do not think they still have a tough time meeting the
standards. Why can't master meet the standards?
Well, if you live in a different state, one state, you see, they don't have actual knowledge.
They do not have actual knowledge.
Well,
They have a measure, you're saying. They do have actual knowledge because of the 18 year old.
Because the 18 year old has other evidence, and then the price of the company, etc. And there's a lot of money on it, and we have to capitalize the expenses.
But you can use Alta Vista for some other more generic search engine. I hope the people know what Alta Vista is. I don't need to go too fast. Okay. You can use something like Alta Vista or Google to search for a query of MP3, and it'll beautifully look for it in certain areas. And so if you're running Alta Vista, and you're under sworn deposition, and somebody says to you, Iris, you have reason to believe that your search engine is being used to facilitate the copying of material that infringes copyright. What's your answer to that question? What Alta Vista does? Yeah, show us all the business then. It's just the search engine. But it's not one of those search engines where underpaid interns try to categorize stuff. You know, cities, UK, you know, Oxford, colleges, social clubs, Oxford Union, bars, bartenders, friends. You know, this is just sort of something obscure. So something like, I don't know, somebody give me a song. A one-word song. Come to command that we can't spell. Satisfaction on MP3. Let's put some satisfaction on MP3. So there's some playlists, there's some stuff from multimedia search engine. Surely one of these is going to be. Oh yeah, you didn't say which version to get. To satisfaction.mp3. So now, as the head of all of this, are you shocked and dismayed to see that your search engine is used this way? Or do you acknowledge and concede your search engine? You do.
Yes.
You're with it. So now all of this has fallen into the same trap. Yeah, the problem is that's an or there.
Right. So you're saying that because
if Alta Vista has actual knowledge that material activity is infringing, they are not off the hook. Right.
Therefore.
Well, certainly if Alta Vista gets caught up by this, which is to say they can't avail themselves of this safe harbor, then they have to start talking about floppy and Sony and all this stuff. The DMCA is going to help them, surely it won't help NASA.
Okay, I was saying that NASA cannot be on the
right. But I'm trying to figure out, you're seeming so concerned about this, even all of this doesn't get off the boat. Right?
Right.
I have your final answer at the time of date. I'm just suggesting that your interpretation of A is making it so that no search engine incredibly escape A, and therefore no search engine can avail itself of this safe harbor. In which case, the safe harbor has two votes. Has no votes. Exactly. It was just sort of a fanciful piece of legislation passed after a long day in the press.
Well, I have to be the conference.
Yeah, it's a service provider. It wants to be a service provider because you've got to be a service provider to even get into the picture to have a chance at this exemption of liability. Yeah, Jason.
Well, if no votes are in the harbor, then the statute is bad is wrong.
Right.
And we should don't get the public opportunity to do it again.
Right.
Or everyone's in the harbor. Because the intent was not to have no votes in the harbor, so we have
certain danger to attend to that, of course, but I agree with you. I agree with you. This is an interesting thing. The task then as legal craftspeople is to figure out how to read this abstruse, obscure little piece of the statute and make it so that Ultimisco wins and Napster loses if you're the RIAA. If you're the RIAA, you don't want Ultimisco to lose on your argument where you're left having to call Congress a bunch of jerks. You like Congress. If you are Napster, of course the task is to say, there's no difference. Where Ultimisco goes, we have to go. Yeah, go Congress. So this is an interesting technical point, and we should figure out how to fit it in to the nascent outline we've drawn of the main argument in the entire case. The argument that starts with we have direct infringement, then how do we figure out how to measure different direct infringements, figure out what's contributory infringement, and all of the pieces of that. Because it's true that Judge Patel makes a lot of hay out of the fact that Napster isn't your normal search engine. They do differ from AltaVista a little bit, to be sure. AltaVista is not a peer-to-peer file sharing network, it is but a search engine. And maybe it's worth it to just briefly explain the difference. AltaVista sends out robots all over the web. It just starts surfing the web as fast as it can. If this is a computer, it can do so very quickly. And it follows every link it finds on a page to a bunch of new pages. And it follows every link on that page to a bunch of new pages until everything has been so-called spidered. And if you ever put something up on the net, you can rest assured within about 2 days it will have been spidered, and somebody searching for it by keyword on AltaVista or Google or something like it will find it. You can often find files weren't meant to be found by the spider activity, which can lead to lawsuits of their own, which we will talk about today. Napster isn't that. Napster is, come on home to Napster. And when you come here, you can make a little directory of stuff you want to share, and we'll maintain that in our master directory. And in the meantime, you can ask us about stuff you want, and we will use our directory that other people have joined to find out where that stuff is, tell you, and then it's up to you to go find it. That's sort of what Napster is doing. All right, so that's qualitatively different. I don't know if it's relevantly different, but it's qualitatively different than what AltaVista is doing. And, said the RIAA, it's a hell of a lot different from what Sony was doing with a Betamax. Why? Because a Betamax, you sell it, and then it's gone. You have no idea afterwards what takes place. On the other hand, Napster isn't a product, it's a service. Somehow there's continuing work that Napster has to put in order to make it go. Napster were shut down, anybody trying to enter into the Napster directory would find that they couldn't trade files using Napster to use a flow through it if the Napster central directory went down. Questions on that much from somebody who hasn't gotten into it? Yes?
I'm
sorry.
Oh, sorry.
Yes.
True. Isn't that one?
Yes.
I guess I'm not very
Napster has the central directory. You log into the Napster server, that's where you get your information and give your own information on what files you have to share. Then you come up with things like Nutella, for which there is no particular central directory. And I'll give you the bare outline right now. For next week, to come to closure on this issue, because we won't be revisiting it probably until the end of the term, we're going to come back to it. To come to closure, I'm going to ask you all to learn a little bit more about Nutella and CNET, and give me a sense of whether RIAA v. Nutella will and should come out any differently than RIAA v. Master. And this is not, if you're not technically inclined, this is going to be a cakewalk, nor should it be unduly impossible to post questions in the message forum, blah, blah, blah. But to give you the running start, with Nutella, are we have Nutella clients on these things? We don't do it. It's better from a room on the ThinkPad type of thing. Nutella is a program for which you start by figuring out somebody else who runs Nutella. And once you have that other person, maybe it's your next door neighbor, what you do is you go to them and say, can you give me the address of other people who use Nutella, because after all, you're using it. And they do. And through this, you start figuring out other people who are using Nutella, and with it, you can start figuring out what other people near you have to share. And you can put your own stuff up to share, and people may start finding their way to you. And in no event is there a single, there's a screen snapshot. Here is the Nutella host catcher. The host catcher is telling you of the internet protocol addresses, those serial numbers that John Postel gave up, of people who also use Nutella. And you have to start with one. You got to just find out the first friend. But once you knew, the virus spreads, and that friend can start giving you more, and then you can find out more. And before you know it, you have a whole list, as long as you care to make it, of people who use Nutella. And with it, you can start asking those hosts, do you have copacabana.mp3? Or do you have bb.txt? It's not limited to any particular kind of file. It doesn't care. It just talks about the file name. You say, do you have it? And Nutella starts asking friends and friends of friends. And because the computer's doing it, it can do it relatively quickly. And eventually, it can render an answer. And once the answer comes back, it can say, great, I'll take it from a given source. Questions on how Nutella works in that brief description? Yes?
And there is a horizon, though, to Nutella. There's a difference between Master, where you have access to everybody who's logged in, and then you can access the files to the directory. But Nutella, everybody has their own different network, and there's a limit of how far out you can go because of the way the signals work, my understanding. So you are shut down after maybe 5 or 6 horizons out, so you can link somebody's computer on their link and on their link. So everybody could have a different network, so you don't have a perfect.
Yes, in some sense, Nutella may be less effective than Master at doing the job of having people share stuff. Having one big central directory, so long as it's scaled, in other words, maybe it doesn't break, may be the logical way to solve this problem if you want to solve it. On the other hand, Nutella may get at the problem being I can't share my music files today. It might get at the problem adequately to the task. That's a good question. Well, you just don't want too many bots scampering about with people too often. It's odd to that. Everybody's just running around the internet saying, do you have satisfaction? I don't know. Do you have satisfaction? And before you know it, you know, you can't download the cyber.law front page because everybody's looking for satisfaction. So, all right, let me just put another question. Let's pull up the full college again. We have time for it. Oh, we have 5 full minutes left in class. Okay, go for it. Okay. Sheriff Corrigan, you're here, Sheriff. Hello, Sheriff. Suppose you have just been appointed general counsel of Harvard University. And suppose further that you've just gotten a letter in the mail from lawyers purporting to represent the talent. And they say, we don't need to remind you about the existence of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and surely you've heard of the swap meet case and Judge Patel's decision in the Master case. Anyway, not to bore you with a bunch of old legal war stories, but we hope you're aware that our own experts have done an investigation and found that fully 75% of the traffic going through the Harvard University network is Master. 75% of the traffic is Master. They are songs being traded. This, of course, is not in accord with your university's research mission, nor with any respect for copyright as a means of protecting property that rightfully belongs to somebody. We therefore ask that you shut down Master on your campus, and we will be happy to make available to you at no cost the proper information technology experts to show you how to scan your network pipes and identify those packets that look like master packets and lose them. What is your reaction? Find it highly offensive. You wouldn't trust their letter.
No.
All right, so the research you've done so far on the threat, the letter hasn't explicitly stated a legal threat yet, but do you think there may be legal exposure to this university for allowing rampant file copying to go on through master that is now fully unknown what is taking place, presuming the 75% figure is accurate? It's true, everybody else is doing it, and then you'll have to CC a few others, but that's okay, we choose you. It's true, we don't get every loser who we want to get you. Do you feel vulnerable? Are you legally vulnerable?
I don't feel legally vulnerable at all.
You don't feel vulnerable? No, we're Harvard. Now you realize, of course, I'm sure some of you thought this, this happened to Yale. Yale caved in. Yale shut down master on the campus. It had just happened to Harvard. Last week, General Counsel's office got this letter from the College of Lawyers. I called the General Counsel's office, my old friend Bob Jonas. Turns out Bob was fired or left under some circumstance. So I talked to his successor. I'm not a good term, but the successor. The successor, I said, why don't you come to class? Give our class a window into how a lawyer for a public institution, public, of course, not the First Amendment public sense, but public in the sense of very tough. How does a lawyer... God, we become jaded. Harvard.com, right? Give us a window into how a lawyer would think about this. And he actually said he couldn't do it. He worried it would violate attorney-client privilege. And I said, you know, don't you feel like a stick in the mud, attorney-client privilege, privilege, you know, give us some hypothetical insight, and he said no. So sadly, he's not coming until the matter is closed, and then is willing to talk to us about it at some point. And I couldn't even tell from his voice whether he was worried or not. But anybody else can tell me, if you're the general counsel of Harvard, you get this letter, do you feel deeply vulnerable? Yes, Rachel.
I think you think one either type of bond.
We're an online service provider. We don't have actual knowledge.
Right.
We don't have actual knowledge?
Well, now
the college
has told us.
I mean, all right, now what?
Then, like, use the
dummy defense
and say we haven't
done
any, you know,
commercially. But I bet you can shut off Napster, and you don't have to shut off anything else. In fact, even Napster itself has removed 700,000 users who were identified by the RIAA and the Taliban as infringing copyright. They have shut down those accounts. They've done it by IP address, and they've also put a cookie on the hard drive that says, this is a bad person. So that even if that laptop gets a new IP address, the cookie says, wait a minute, don't let this person on. Napster has agreed to do that. Precisely so they can claim to have fallen under the appropriate DMCA carve-out. So at least, Harvard, are you willing, if we tell you the internet protocol addresses of students and staff and faculty of yours who we can point to as having copyrighted music through Napster, will you kick them off your network?
My guess is to say that they don't want to do that.
I'm sure it's crazy. Some amendment. It might be the quartering amendment. I'm free. Yeah. Anybody else want to react to this? Michael.
Maybe our tax department wants to with creating that problem to free up the central space, but it's not legal issue.
Do you think a student might be less likely to attend Harvard if they acknowledge the community of action altogether?
There, Harvard. Because of the way I use the Commodore 64, they show
them. All right. So, to come to full closure on this, we're going to ask our panel to really try and find arguments that Ben got started for us in text up with the book. Let us see the arguments, the counter-arguments, and the relevant ways in which the various cases and statutes have gotten shoved in here to come to at least an understanding of the arguments in an after case. And I hope now that this week has concluded, we have a sense of the toolbox that is available. What a toolbox with bizarre looking Swiss Army knives it is. And somebody who is a publisher of stuff that falls under Title 17, stuff that is copyrighted, wants to go after some internet-related instrumentality that's making it easy to rip off this stuff. Next week, we are going to turn to a couple other items in the toolbox, apart from copyright, that are available to those who want to stop information from flowing that they believe they have some proprietary information. And after that, we're going to tackle a little bit about jurisdiction. Good luck on a little history this week. I hope you find it fun. Feel free to send questions, comments, anything else on my account. Jack, you have something quick.
Working
today,
the questions are up and available, but if there's
something
you don't get,
you
know, try
logging
anyway, just
maybe email Harvard. And if you think you're in this class, you're not getting lots of little emails from the administrative notes, you need to check with us because we don't think you're in the class. All right, see you next week. And thank you all.